Good morning. It really has been a while, and I'm sorry. Today is Sunday, May 17th, and I need to kind of break in to explain what has been going on. I've had two wonderful conversations in limbo since February, and I'm sorry for not getting these shows out. Both were in preparation of Treefort Music Fest, and although Treefort has been rescheduled to occur September 23rd through the 27th, and for which I'll do my same annual coverage, I've been both too busy and haven't had the headspace for podcasting or editing. I'm sorry, Brandon, and I'm sorry, Tres Leches. So, I guess I'm an essential worker, it turns out. But as everyone's lives have been interrupted for the past 2 months, mine clicked into a new gear. A new, fairly intense routine started as I entered into my quarantine work life, which means taking more precautions and procedures at the grocery store I work, but it also means that every day is pretty busy, long, and because of other various responsibilities, my days off don't stretch as far as they used to. And, just as you, my days of the week became just as meaningless. All the patterns changed. Anyway, I'm making an effort to get these shows out now. Give them a listen, and know that more are coming in the future. Since Treefort is on the horizon for the beginning of fall, I'll have to start digging back in now to see if I can have some more interesting conversations. Checking in to see how bands and creative folks have been making ends meet in this difficult time. Anyway, I miss you and hope that you've been well. Stay safe, and I'll be in touch really soon. I have been unhappy for many years now. I have seen in the faces of young people walking down the street a resemblance to people who died during my childhood. The period of my life of which I'm about to tell involves a late night in the winter of 1989 when I was 15 years old, and a certain girl died in front of me. Her name was Rosemary Blackwell. It happened when she and I were living with a family in foster care. And though the details are complicated, I still think about her often. I'm alive and she's dead. I should tell you this is not a confession, nor is it a way to untangle the roots and find meaning. Rosemary is dead. People live and die. People kill themselves or they just get killed. The rest of us live on, burdened by what is inescapable. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's February 10th, and we're just a little over a month away from Treefort. Treefort, you say? The Treefort Music Fest is a 5-day indie rock festival which is held at numerous venues throughout downtown Boise, Idaho in late March. This year, 2020, Treefort occurs March 25th through the 29th. A branch of Treefort is Storyfort, the literary portion of the event, which is absolutely free and open to the public. More information can be found at treefortmusicfest.com. Today, for 42 Minutes, we'll meet a writer appearing this year at Storyfort, Brandon Hobson. Hobson is the author of 4 books and is an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation tribe. His writing has appeared in such places as Conjunctions, Noon, the Paris Review Daily, The Believer, and elsewhere. His most recent novel is Where the Dead Sit Talking, and was a finalist for the 2018 National Book Award, as well as a Best Book of 2018 by NPR's Code Switch and Kirkus Reviews. It was also longlisted for the 2019 Aspen Words Literary Prize. Set in rural Oklahoma during the late 1980s, Where the Dead Sit Talking is a startling, authentically voiced and lyrically written Native American coming-of-age story. With his single mother in jail, Sequoia, a 15-year-old Cherokee boy, is placed in foster care with the Trout family. Literally and figuratively scarred by his mother's years of substance abuse, Sequoia keeps mostly to himself, living with his emotions pressed deep below the surface. At least until he meets 17-year-old Rosemary, another youth staying with the Trouts. Sequoia and Rosemary bond over their shared Native American background and tumultuous paths through the foster care system, but as Sequoia's feelings toward Rosemary deepen, the precariousness of their lives and the scars of their past threaten to undo them both. Where the Dead Sit Talking was published in 2018 by Soho Press and is also available as an audiobook. For more information about this work, visit BrandonHobson.com. It truly is an honor to be meeting Brandon today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So I know that you, you're also a college professor. I'm just curious. It's been a few years since I took a literature class. Could you, how does one define literature?
Oh, wow. That's a, how long is this program? that's a long answer, right? Right now I mostly teach creative writing, and which is basically just fiction writing. So I haven't taught literature in, it's been about a year. And when I did teach it, it was mainly the sort of contemporary American literature to undergrads. And so I guess to answer your question on how one defines it, I think because literature is an art, much like music and painting and film, I think we have to look at literature as existing in a place that can move us or unsettle us or affect us in ways more than just simply entertain us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the last bit. So that's something that arose as I was reading your book. Like, I was just wondering, like, I know that, like, oftentimes in bookstores, there's a section that they call literary fiction. Do you think writers set out to write literary fiction, or is that just something that happens depending on whatever it is they're exploring?
I think I think writers set out to write literary fiction. I mean, part of it, again, is I think many of us come to writing from first becoming readers and figuring out that what we've read does more than just simply entertain us. In other words, it affects us in ways that go way deeper than that, and where we can sort of feel empathy, compassion, and at the same level feel unsettled or disturbed by what we're reading says a lot more than just simply, you know, trying to entertain us. So I think thinking about much more character than plot, for example, literary fiction, you know, is often more concerned with voice, with character or characters, with an emotional appeal, much more than just simply what happens.
Yeah, yeah. So that like a good thriller is really plotted well, oftentimes, and gripping, but at the same time, you know, when it's done, it's kind of done.
Right. And I think, you know, in literary fiction, we look at, you know, there can be a story about nothing, nothing necessarily. Like, look at Raymond Carver's stories back from the 80s. A lot of those stories aren't about anything. I mean, you know, we come to the end of them, and in those stories, you know, you think about plot, it's nothing really happened, right? I mean, you know, they're a lot more interested, I think, in character, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, so the interesting thing when I was reading your book is that I thought about the layers of it, where it seemed like that was the thing that I found really interesting was, you know, so you had the character layer and they're these, you know, individuals moving around. But at the same time, I thought that they stood for larger things also, but then it wasn't, you know, it wasn't straightforward either. So, you know, there was, it was a story of colonialism, but also a story of class, you know?
Right.
I'm wondering about how much intentionality you had with, you know, some of those layers.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely class. When we're talking about, you know, working class, I'm often interested in writing about working class or, you know, lower middle class, I think, and families that, I mean, I think with this book, right, that, you know, we have sort of a middle class, lower middle class family here who've taken in foster children. And how do they react to, you know, taking in kids from different sort of, you know, families and so I guess I'm interested in writing about class. Yeah.
Well, on that note, with class in mind, so I thought there was something really interesting about the setting, and I thought the setting meant both the time and the place, but also like the class element. And so Sequoia, one of his things that he liked to do was just kind of go out at night and walk around. And and I grew up in a small town in northern Idaho, a mining town. And that was kind of, you know, one of the things that we did for fun growing up. And so I was just wondering, you know, so that's what's interesting about, like, when there's like a timelessness to various things, but I didn't know if that was, you know, if that was a, like a 1980s thing, or if that was an actual class thing, maybe.
I don't know if it's a class thing, or at least from my experience. I mean, I think, you know, I think kids used to walk around. I know I have a 12-year-old, you know, who's not interested at all in walking around, you know, because there are a lot more things to do, I think. You know, he has his phone and his, you know, video games and you know, access to movies. And so, I mean, maybe class is part of it, actually. So I know that with Sequoia growing up, you know, being a teenager in 1989, you know, and not really having access to those things that kids do now. So I think that kids probably, maybe they don't walk around as much now.
And then I think there was a lot more freedom back then as far as longer leashes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, so in terms of like these layers that I was talking about, well, let's just divert into George for a second, and even Sequoia a little bit. So they're both foster kids in this family, the Trout family's house. But the way that they kind of process reality and look at the world, and they're kind of detached, and they have their own mm-hmm. space, it felt mm-hmm. almost a little bit like a metaphor for writing, you know, like the way a writer's mind kind of interacts with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that you thought about in them, or was that just something that I read into it?
Well, I maybe a little bit with George, because, you know, he is a writer. I mean, you know, a 12 or 13 year old, you know, writing a novel. And I think he is interested in solitude, which, you know, and I think at some point in the book, he even mentions, I think, you know, it's been a while, but, you know, mentions, you know, talking a lot about his book, which I think certainly the writers do, like, to talk about their book. And he's, you know, on the spectrum, the autism spectrum. And I think I would say that if anything, he represents writing more than anyone else in the book, if that answers.
Yeah, the question. I mean, so his brain was so fascinating, and I definitely took him in as like a fully realized character. Like he was interesting. But he was cataloging music for the sake of cataloging. You know, he didn't even care about necessarily the music itself, but he wanted to know, you know,
right,
the culture and where things stood and how things fit together and how the world worked.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for his cataloging and obsession with music was a different way of talking about obsession, which I this book, I was really interested in writing about obsession. Sequoia's obsession with Rosemary, George's obsession with his novel and with music and the lyrics of music and the liner notes of music and the culture of 80s pop culture, right? And then also the town's obsession in some ways with Rosemary as well. So you know, definitely that's one of the reasons I listed all the 80s bands and pop cultural references that George was interested to fit the theme of obsession in the book.
That also went a long way to really just like realizing that setting. You know, there was something you captured that high school 80s moment with those references.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now we can talk about Sequoia a little bit, because he definitely, the layer that I thought was really interesting with him, and he was also, you know, like George, a realized character, and I viewed him that way, but then he seemed to stand for so much more, you know, as far as like a whole experience, say, right? So I heard you on a talk talking about one of the themes that you wanted to explore is displacement. And so, you know, he, as a foster child, definitely was displaced from, you know, a normal or a traditional background or whatever. But then, as you know, as a stand-in, he could also represent more, you know, the whole Native experience on some level. And so, with that in mind, I found it really interesting how Sequoia's reaction, a lot of the time, he would just have these violent thoughts. And I, you know, I wonder, I mean, so that they were interesting to me, but you know, they definitely spoke more toward the idea of the larger cultural experience to me.
Yeah. I wanted Sequoia's, he has violent thoughts like many 15-year-old boys. And I think especially boys who come out of homes, come out of, you know, abusive households and, you know, very traumatic experience. So Sequoia, I mean, I was a social worker for 7 years, and during those 7 years, I continually had young boys that would talk about, you know, their trauma, and a lot of that sort of displacement and violence, right, that I think comes out of, obviously comes out of anger. But what do they do with that? You know, you have to really sort of, you know, work through that. And at such a young age, you know, those thoughts are just sort of, you know, streamlining through his mind. And I mean, I understand that, you know, it can be, you know, difficult for people, I guess, on some level to read, I think. But I tried to really make that as realistic of a portrayal of a 15-year-old boy as possible, right? And so, but that displacement and violence might also extend out beyond just trauma to cultural displacement, and how Sequoia feels displaced in terms of his own identity and understanding what it means to be Native, and also understanding what it means to be a boy. If he calls himself a boy, he's a little bit androgynous. You know, I wanted to make Sequoia androgynous. And part of my reason for that as well is, There are a lot of androgynous 15-year-old Natives out there, and they're not being, you know, as far as I can tell, they're, you know, it's difficult to find stories of them. And so there were a lot of factors, I think, that were in making up and thinking about Sequoia's character.
Yeah, so that was definitely a thought I had, was that how does one derive meaning in a dominant culture that doesn't necessarily reflect you back to you? You know, the stories that are out there are not necessarily your stories.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, can you elaborate on that? Is that
it's I think something that all people do. You know, we need stories to find meaning in our lives, and so
right.
If the dominant culture is telling stories, you know, that, you know, don't necessarily pertain to your place or your, you know, class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for Native, he happens to be a Native American, kid, you know, in this book. And I guess in terms of thinking about what other books are out there, you know, there aren't a lot, or at least when I was interested in writing this book, I thought about wanting to write about, you know, a Native American teenager feeling displaced in a non-Native foster home, and also thinking about are there other stories out there? There aren't many, right, that are sort of addressing this. So.
Yeah. So something else that's kind of interesting that I thought about is how, you know, because supernatural elements are, you know, it seems like it's more a normal part of Native culture. So like the dreams and the visions and the prophecy and that kind of stuff is tied in, and it just works seamlessly. But then to arrive at that same kind of it's sad, because in Western culture the only place for that kind of material, if it's not religious, is like in a horror film. Like it has to be the supernatural. Yeah. is only access through horror and like Western culture. So I'm just wondering, I mean, so at times I did think that there was like horror elements in this, but it just had so much more depth than like straight horror.
I mean, it's, in a way, it is kind of a horror novel, I think, maybe. I don't know. I mean, the horrors of being a foster being fostered by, in a small town, and feeling so displaced. At the same time, I'm very much interested in Shirley Jackson. I think she was a big influence on me. And so
And
I used to think if
she
there's a
wrote
right.
The Lottery. Is that her? Or the Hill
Yeah.
House too,
That's
I think. Is that her?
Yeah, that's Shirley Jackson. Yeah. And so, I think if there's at one time a writer I wanted to be like, it was maybe Shirley Jackson, because I thought, wow, when I, when I, a long time ago, when I was reading her books and her stories, I would come away thinking, that I'm very unsettled by these stories, and what is it that's making, it's usually has to do with the character, and but that sort of darkness, I don't know that we'd call it horror, right? But there's that sort of darkness that exists in the displacement of the characters. And I think, there are a number of writers who do that really, really well. Otessa Moshfegh is one, I think, that does that, certainly in Eileen and in a lot of her short stories, just phenomenal. So there are a number of writers that I see that, Angela Carter might be another one as well. I don't sit here and go through a list, but I think if there's anything I'm interested in for the reader, it's that feeling of displacement or being unsettled, right? Not necessarily disturbed, but unsettled, I think is a good word.
So, how difficult was it to get like into the mind of a 15-year-old?
Well, I don't think, I mean, it's like acting, I think, right? It's like maybe if you're playing the role of someone, and you really have to get inside their head and try to, hear the things they would say, or hear the, I think first person, writing often inside the head of a narrator is a lot like acting, I think. Which it's not easy, and I had to really go back to myself as a 15-year-old, and then I had to also think back on the number of kids that I worked with, who were incarcerated, and kids who were in foster care, and go back and look at and think about the things that they told me and the things they shared with me, and think about it in terms of a larger context as well. So, I mean, it's not obviously like all writing. I mean, it's not easy. It's very difficult, and either I did a good job or I did a horrible job. I have no idea, but it's not easy. Yeah.
Well, and so as like now you have these two hats, you have a writing hat and a social working hat. How do you like, do you think literature is a way to somehow mitigate the trauma?
I think so. I you mean
For
for just
someone,
the general.
yeah, like the displaced person is can you find solace in literature? Is that
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, we see ourselves, certainly, or our experiences, I think. And that's often the only way that we can, it can combat loneliness, and it can combat isolation, and it can combat, you know, the feelings that, feelings of uncertainty that certainly we've felt through literature, kind of blanketing those, I think, and soothing us in certain ways. So yeah, I would say yes.
So yeah, and as a social worker, did you use that as one of your tools?
When I worked in juvenile lockup, I did a little bit. Yeah, we had a library of books in the detention center where I worked, and the kids had 1 hour of reading time, or more, but there was an hour of reading time, and so I would, you know, I donated a few books, and you know, did it when I could, that's tough.
Well, so I definitely like the whole culture of books, you know, the whole experience.
Yeah.
And I'm a little closed-minded about video games, but I think there's a lot of really interesting narrative possibilities in that whole arena. And I wonder, does your 12-year-old probably like video games and not want to read like mine?
He does, yeah. He loves video games, but at least now he's really interested in the NBA 2K, or you know, the he's a big basketball fan, so it's kind of nice now, because he's not, you know, playing. For a while he was playing, you know, the, I can't think of what it's called, but you know, sort of violent, where they go around shooting people,
Fortnite or the other
Fortnite,
one.
Yeah. Yeah, he was playing Fortnite for a while, but now he's very much, you know, sort of obsessed with NBA and which is a much healthier obsession, you know, in terms of video games. But I don't push reading on him. We talk about it some, and we talk about stories, and you know, he's sometimes interested in, I have a very different life, I think, than his friend's parents, because of, you know, travel and, you know, writing, where it's like he comes in and, you know, I'm a lot of time, you know, working alone, I, you know, we have books all over the house, so it's available there for him. But yeah, he's totally into basketball right now, which is good. So I'm not going to force him to read, and hope that he, you know, develops an interest at some point.
Could you speak a little bit about how you work? You know, is it,
sure,
inspirationally, or are you, you know, by the clock, you need to log on so many hours? You know, how does your process look?
Well, I was teaching last year when I was living in Oklahoma. I'm living in New Mexico now, but when I was in Oklahoma, I was teaching about 5 or 6 classes a semester. So
that's a lot, I think, right? I mean, if you're teaching, any more than four is pretty a lot.
It is a lot, because, you know, and that's a whole other, you know, subject of how academia is, you know, a problematic in terms of, especially adjunct.
Yes, I know this.
Are,
my wife is adjunct.
Yeah, I mean, they're just, you know, it's very, very, that's very low pay for part-time teaching often, and just the workload if you want to do a good job, I mean, you can go in there and do a terrible job, right? And the students probably most places won't care. They just want to get in and out, right?
Yeah.
And get a good grade. But I, you know, so I was teaching a lot. I was teaching, and it was a full time. I was at a small 2-year community college in Oklahoma and teaching about 6 classes a semester. And, but it was, you know, I like teaching and I was just kind of writing whenever I could. You know, any spare time I had, I would, you know, steal the time. And Stuart Onan says you have to steal the time. When people ask him, how do you find time to write? Well, you steal the time. And so that means not watching much, if any, TV. I mean, I watch more now because I have more time now, but you know, stealing the time and writing whenever I could. Now I have a lower teaching load, luckily, and so I'm able to, you know, write various times that I wasn't before. So I most of my writing is probably done either late at night or in the mornings after I get up. So, you know, I don't know that I work better at any time. As long as I have the solitude, I can work well.
And as far as your drafting goes, do you get it all out pretty close the first time, or do you end up rewriting multiple times?
A lot of rewriting. I do like drafting, just sort of. That's the most fun part. Is drafting it, I think. You know, the difficult part comes when, you know, when you're having to streamline the narrative and find the structure. And so my new novel right now, that's, you know, what I've mostly been doing is, you know, kind of rearranging and restructuring the book. And so, you know, that becomes tedious at times and less fun, but the most fun part is definitely drafting, and I think it should be fun.
Well, so how did you get in mixed up with the Treefort stuff?
Jonathan Evison, he asked me a while back if I would be interested in coming to read, and I said absolutely. That sounds like a you know, great time. He's friends with, again, Stuart Onan, I mentioned again, who was a teacher of mine a long time ago. And so they're friends, and so I think maybe that's how the connection was made there. But Jonathan emailed me and asked me, and I said, absolutely, just tell me when, and I'll be there. You bet. So.
Yeah, so it is interesting because I've spoken to a lot of the writers that have come to Treefort, and a lot of them definitely do have kind of a working class point of view, that they're interested in working class stories.
Yeah, I know. I listened to your interview with Camille Acker from, she was here at New Mexico State last year. Teaching, and so.
And did you know her there, or was that you crossed?
No, I did. We did cross paths briefly last year when I came down here, but I didn't. She was done at the end of the year, and so she moved on. But I liked the interview for sure.
Well, so for me, the Treefort is really interesting. It bills itself as a festival of discovery. And so every year the music, it's just a lot of names that I've never heard of before as far as the actual bands themselves go. But then you realize that these are people that have been working on their music, you know, for years and years and years. And they're all, you know, any one of them could be poised to be the next Lizzo, you know, who performed back in 2015 or whenever that was, you know.
Yeah.
But it's the same
Yeah.
kind of discovery with the writers too, where it's just interesting because writers seem like rock stars are rock stars, but writers are like everyday people who, you know, when they really have a bestseller, all of a sudden, you know, become rock stars somehow. But they still spend their, you know, every day by themselves in their writing room.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I consider some writers are like rock stars, right? I mean, you know, they're definitely ones that everybody's heard of, and then but it's a very weird world, I think, because there are so many writers producing amazing books and amazing work, but you know, so many people haven't heard of them. So, you know, that's
And that was my point
interesting.
where, like, I read these things that I wouldn't necessarily be introduced to, but then it definitely is interesting and broadens my horizon. But then also, from a synchronicity standpoint, it's interesting to see where these different things play together on some levels. Like I was saying, Jonathan Evanson definitely is interested in working class stories or even lower class stories. So
Yeah.
synchronicity is one of the fun things that I enjoy talking about. Do you have any great synchronicity stories? I mean, so it seems like in writing you can't really get away with it because it seems like a cheat, but in real life, you know, some of these coincidences are just so much fun.
Yeah, synchronicity. It's weird because my wife and I talk about these things all the time. We're like, wow, that is so weird. How did that possibly, you know, I have, I mean, does it need to be writing related or
No, not necessarily.
just a moment of synchronicity?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I have a lot of deja vu here. Like, I find myself, you know, when we first moved to Las Cruces, I was driving from the university to my house, and I had this very weird, you know, moment of deja vu. And I don't know how to explain those necessarily, you know, but I was getting them pretty regularly here. And you know, when you get them, it almost sort of stops you, you know, in, you know, where you're like, oh my, you know, I just can't even, like, it happens in the classroom a lot. And so, but that's not, I don't know that that's really, I mean, deja vu is not really synchronicity, is it?
Well, it all is of a piece. There was someone who was I read a book. He was saying that, you know, those are almost could be considered precognitive moments where somehow you're remembering your future. You know, the deja vu is something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very strange. Is it white noise? DeLillo's White Noise, where he talks about wanting to find a drug that makes one feel deja vu. Is that White Noise?
I haven't read that one, but DeLillo, I
Okay.
think, is accused of all kinds of stuff like that all the time because I just read Underworld, and it's
Yeah.
uncanny how, you know, so here's a book set in New York City, and you know, it's intimate with, it just feels like somehow he's foreseeing 9/11 before it happens, kind of like it.
I know. Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, that was, I remember at one point thinking the lyrics of Morrissey too. Morrissey was having all these sort of revelatory lyrics from his days in the Smiths. You know, that I would then something would happen in the news, and I would look back and I was like, oh, well, wait a minute, Morrissey pointed to that. right? And shoplifters of the world, you know, and then there's, so, I mean, yeah, I love those sort of moments, but I don't know that there's one moment of synchronicity that I can think of at the moment. But we do have a lot of coincidences, like meeting someone from Oklahoma here, you know, and so.
Yeah. Well, are you able to speak a little bit about your new work and what it's about, and then when do you foresee it coming out?
Yeah, it should be out next year. I think it'll be, I think right now we don't have an exact pub date, but I'm guessing early 2021, so about a year. And it has to do with a family who is dealing with the loss of a family member, but it's also concerned with an ancestor's experience with the Trail of Tears and how Cherokee mythology plays a role in all of that. So maybe there's some synchronicity in this novel, right?
Well, that was 42 minutes. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me so much. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You've been listening to Brandon Hobson on 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio on thesyncbook.com. Check out his work at his website, brandonhobson.com, as well as Treefort this spring in Boise, Idaho. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, check out past shows, or just subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, check out others, as currently all the SyncBook Radio archives are free. We also feature a great search engine to help you find what you need. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com. Thanks so much, and the bad spirits followed us like smoke, creeping into our house and into my dreams at night.
was all right. You know it was all right. And it was all right. It was all right. Yeah. Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man. Yes, ma'am.